I don't think you're crazy, but I'm going to rewind even further, and I'm going to tell you ancient hieroglyphics is the first technology, also known as emojis.
I am so thrilled and honored to have Phil Gerbyshack with me today. Phil is one of the most interesting people I know. He's also one of the most intelligent people I know. He's an expert on technology. Phil is a great friend. He's an amazing guy. And he's working on a new book. Phil, do you want to share the new book you're working on? Because I think sure. It's just, I love the title. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. So it's called What's Your Weird? I'm co-authoring it with Shauna Sukow. And it is all about taking your uniqueness as an individual. Part of it, half of the book will be about individual, how to take your individual uniqueness up and use that as leverage. And then the other half of the book, if you flip it over, it's all about how corporations can take their uniqueness and the uniqueness of the people that work for them and flip that over and turn that into something amazing. It's not about what makes us the same, because the same is same, right? Same is lame. Jay Baer says that all the time. Same is lame. So we want to be different. And that's what's weird.
And you're weird, right? I mean, you
will. I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. I'm going to embrace that, right? I really do think so. I mean, there's a lot of things that make me weird, right? I'm colorblind. I wear colorful glasses. I am, to your point, I'm a technologist, but I'm a sales trainer. Well, how many technologists do you know that can train salespeople incredibly? Yeah. Not just sort of, hey, here's the tech. No, I can train sales skills because I sold. I was a stockbroker. I've sold high-speed internet. I've sold software myself, right? So I have credibility in that space, and I can train the heck out of people because my heart is for the person and helping them turn up their uniqueness, their weirdness, another level so that they can prepare, practice, and produce and get great results. That's the whole plan. But until you do that, until you're comfortable, until you're confident, it's really hard to let your uniqueness shine through.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you're also one of the best LinkedIn trainers I've ever met. I want to talk with you today about how technology impacts culture. And so people who listen to Culture Matters know that I don't script these conversations. These are just, we just talk and hopefully have very, very interesting conversations and guests. But I've never had a conversation about how technology, not here, right? I've had those conversations, but how technology actually impacts culture. Or does culture impact technology, right? So I want to just open the conversation. Then, like in my mind, there's so many places I want to go with this, but you may have several places you want to go with this. But I think it's a fascinating conversation. So give me a couple things, Phil, that I guess recent. Let's start recent, right? Yeah. What are some of the technological advances recently that, you know, there are the obvious, right? Like the touch screen. But maybe some others that people, maybe they're not seeing so clearly, but they really are impacting culture. What's out there that's going on that either it's happened or it's happening and we should start getting ready for it?
Well, one of the big things that's going on is the idea of a deep fake with videos and audio and images. So deep fake, meaning if I've got enough of my likeness on the internet and I've said enough words, so not only is there enough pictures, but there's enough sound, basically you can fake it out and make it look like I've said just about anything. And as someone who's probably got 20, 30, 40,000 hours over the last 15 years of audio and video, not all published, of course, but somewhere, somehow people have recorded that, right? And lots of pictures. I mean, if you Google it, do a Google image search, you find tons of pictures of me and videos and stuff. I mean, right? I'm a speaker. I'm a trainer. Right. My goal is to get out there. So you put all that together. And now what you can do is you can stitch together and make it look like I've said just about anything and fake people out, even though I didn't say it in that order. You can't really say, well, Phil, you did say that. Well, I did say that for sure. I mean, that's where like our phone, right? We get calls and those automated systems, I've taken to answering them and then not saying a word. Because if they catch my hello, if they catch my, hi, this is Phil Gerbyshack, if they catch that, now they could use that in a voice recognition software that now fakes out and says, yep, that's Phil, right? Like they did in the action movies, right? Like Jason Bourne and stuff like that. So that's here. Deepfakes. Right. In fact, the University of Buffalo, I was listening to an NPR program this morning on the drive in, the University of Buffalo is combating deepfakes. Now they haven't said how yet. but I'm curious how they're doing that. But deepfakes, the fact that now basically you could get just about anybody to say anything from a cultural perspective, you can absolutely inflame people by what you say, because words and video and things, they look so real, man. It's so scary.
That's crazy.
So scary. So that's the big
thing. It's scary to me because obviously with what I do on culture, so I'm very, very careful about what I say and do publicly, right?
That's right. Yep.
Because I don't want to destroy the cultural mastery brand. So you're saying someone could take clips of me, of what I say and write, and make me say something that is extremely derogatory, for example, of a group of people. So, wow, that's scary.
Yeah.
So why would they, I can see why they would do that to politicians. Is that where that started? Is that what?
No, that probably started with revenge porn, to be quite honest with you.
Really? Right?
So think about, so if you've ever, you know, if you've ever had a hard breakup, mm-hmm. many times there's some anger there. And sure. I hate to say this, but often it's men because we have more animosity, more hostility inside of us. We just have more adrenaline. Not always, but often it's men. And they will, you know, they'll post a private picture of their ex-girlfriend.
Okay.
Well, imagine though, if a woman that turned me down, now instead, I could take her picture and put it over a porn star and basically have sex with my ex-girlfriend.
Oh my.
Right? So now we've gotten not only revenge, but now we've got fantasy. Okay. And now let's say she completely shoots me down and she says, you know what? You need to destroy all those pictures of me. You know, I sent them to you in the heat of passion and let's destroy those. Well, instead of destroying them, you go to some deep fake site and you upload them all to get back at her for being such a nasty person. And I'm using air quotes.
Right. I understand.
You're watching at home, right? Some nasty person. And now you've got enough that you could destroy her life. And some of these guys are all about the fact that if you turn me down, I'm going to destroy you. Because guys, and some women too, certainly want power. I would not surprise me, a Harvey Weinstein, this Epstein character that quote unquote killed himself, right? Any of this would not surprise me if they have just a cadre of hard drives of material that could get released out there for revenge purposes. And now imagine, because the technology exists. It's already there, Ricardo. This is not new. And from a cultural perspective, I really think this is a big challenge because culturally, some cultures are more technologically advanced, some are less. Some are more adapted, some are less. Some come from third world countries where they don't have any tech, and then they come to the United States if they do, or they come to some more technologically advanced country, and now they struggle with that. So I think that's one of the big ones that I'm worried about from a culture perspective, because you have worked so hard. We as a race, the human race, have worked so hard to try to break down some of these barriers. And now, really, with this deep fake stuff, you could totally crush that with a 10 second clip of something that I didn't even say. I mean, that's scary stuff to me.
It is scary stuff. And especially when you combine that, say, with the call out culture, who has a desire to, you know, we used to live in a world, Phil, where you remember this show, Petticoat Junction? I mean, this is years ago. You remember this? And there's mm-hmm. Uncle Joe who's out in the front rocker there and we used to live in that world, this is years ago, where Uncle Joe would say something and everybody would just go, ah, that's just Uncle Joe, right?
Yep.
And then some place in history, we started to shift into Uncle Joe needs to apologize. And so Uncle Joe started apologizing and we would forgive Uncle Joe. But we're not even in that world anymore. Now we're in a world where we certainly don't want to say, well, that's just Uncle Joe. Let him be. And we really don't even want to forgive people when they perhaps make cultural mistakes. There are many people who want to use other people's mistakes in life. And almost all of these are cultural mistakes because culture is humanity, right?
Yeah.
And people want to use those and make spectacles of those people and make examples out of them. And there's no thought to whether or not it destroys a person or their career or who they are. There's no room for dialogue and discussion. And, you know, as I say, you know, let's cuddle people in, not call them out. But I could see this deep fake being used by the call out culture to really create quite havoc from a cultural standpoint as well.
Yeah. Well, and flip that over, right? Forget about the call. Imagine the silence culture, the shut the F up culture that we have as well, right? Because we have both sides screaming at each other. We have the call out culture for sure, but we also have the, hey, shut up, your opinion doesn't matter.
Right.
And the problem is most of us are somewhere in the middle. Most of us are somewhat rational people. I would argue 70%, maybe even 80% of people are rational, intelligent, willing to forgive people. But the two ends of the spectrum, that the call out culture and the shut the F up culture, I think are going to be the ones that use this the most, because you have the, if you don't do exactly what I say, I'm going to release this video.
Right.
And on the other hand, the other hand is, Ricardo, I was at an event and I heard you say something stupid, and therefore I'm going to call you out on it. Technology has made us given us such a quicker trigger finger, especially for cultural stuff, and so quick to assume that you're wrong and I'm right culturally, that we're in trouble, man. And technology just makes that so much faster. I mean, I can screenshot. I don't care if you posted privately or not. If I can see it, I can screenshot it.
Yes.
If I can see it, I can download it. If I can see it, I can share it. Ricardo, we've never met, and I love you to pieces, man. You're a good, good friend, right? Like, I trust you, man. Except once, right? Except once.
One time.
Right? We never met except once.
Yes.
We had lunch, right? So, but think about that. It's been 10 years, man. We've been hanging out.
Yes.
Right? One time we meet.
Yes.
That's fascinating, right? So that's the power of the internet. So for me, as someone who loves people, my grandmother, my mom's mom, she was the glue in our family. And culturally, she was the matriarch. Culturally, she was the one that knew the entire family tree. She could write all that up. We're Irish, French, and then my dad's side is Polish, 100%. So, you know, we talk about kind of being, you know, mixed. My mom was the first non-100% purebred Polish woman that married into the family.
Really? So do you speak any Polish?
Na zdrowie. That's cheers. Drink beer. That's all I got, man. Maybe punchki. Punchki, right? That's a donut that they serve on Fat Tuesday. That's all I got, man.
So have you had any like internal compunction, you know, like to go to Poland? And
not even a little.
No.
Not even a little.
Really?
Nope. I'm a citizen of the world. I'm not a citizen of Poland. I'm not from Krivets anymore. And I don't say that because I love my little town. Don't get me wrong. I'm thankful for everything it gave me. But I'm from the world now.
So when you went in the Navy, mm-hmm. where'd you travel to? What are the different places you've been?
Yeah, so I went to boot camp. I went to boot camp in Orlando, Florida. So 90 minutes from where I live today.
Okay.
I went to school in Pensacola, Florida, right near Pensacola Beach. I went from there to Alameda, California, San Francisco, Berkeley, Oakland, all of that. That's where I got my culture. That's where I really grew up fast. And then my last year in the Navy, I was in Seoul, Korea.
And you did, when you went to Seoul, Korea, mm-hmm. what did you learn culturally by going to Korea, South Korea? Because you weren't in North Korea.
No.
Not open, right?
No, that's correct.
But not so much what did you learn about the South Koreans, but what did you learn about yourself?
Yeah, for sure. So first, I learned that I was more racist than I thought I was.
Interesting.
And because I knew I had challenges, right? Like when I lived in California, I was very homophobic, very homophobic. I thought it was contagious. I thought you could catch being gay. And so it was really, really tough in California. But then going to Korea, the way that I learned about Korea was almost like a 1970s movies. It was really backwards. It wasn't very modern. So I thought mistakenly that most of the Koreans hated us. Now, I'm not telling you that they love us as Americans, but they didn't hate us. So that was, I heard that and I felt some tension about that. And then, you know, the military is such a small cog of the world because everything is so contained, right? So I can shop on base. I can get my dry cleaning on base. I can eat on base. I live on base. I mean, really, I'd never have to leave the base. And I wanted to leave the base. I mean, that was one of the reasons why I went to Korea. I wanted to see other things. So we'd go out in town. And the problem is you know, just like I was racist and I had stereotypes and I had ideas, many of the South Koreans, they treated us all the same, right? So all the Americans got treated the same. They would, you know, we're all drunkards. So in many ways, right, the Korean stereotype of us, GIs, very correct, very correct. And yet I learned that if I took the time to meet people one-on-one, I could change their perception. Right. And that was the biggest thing that I learned about myself, is that while I was pretty racist, man. I know that. I couldn't figure out how to fix it, but I would have one-on-one conversations with people, and slowly over time, you know, I'm sure I still have some racism in me. I mean, I'm human. I still have some biases. I do my absolute best to not be, but I'm not naive enough to think that I'm perfect.
Right.
That it's a process, right? We're all getting better. We're learning more. But yeah, so over time, you know, one person became two. One of my best buddies was Captain Kim in the Korean ROK Army, became a really, really good friend of mine. We went karaokeing together. Karaoke in Korean is called Nodaebang. So we went to Nodaebang together. That was so fun. And he sang Honestly by Billy Joel. It was so much fun. And now, funny enough, there's actually there's a Korean restaurant here in Tampa that my buddy took over for me in Korea. He lives here now too. He moved down here, so we're close together. So we went there for dinner Monday night, and we're gonna go back for Nodaebang.
Really?
Yep.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So I want to come back to something you've said now on two or three occasions, and that is an admission that, at least from your perspective, you have had some racist views. But I think, you know, this is my experience with culture. I think it's important. I'm curious as to what your understanding of racism is, because I think it's important. I think a lot of times, especially in the United States, right, we're like really quick to call people racist. And I would contend that most of the time it's actually not racism. Most of the time it's ethnicism or some element of culturalism. Because racism, by definition, is I'm making a judgment or an assumption about you because of the color of your skin, right? That's racism. Everything else is ethnicism or culturalism.
Okay.
And so I just want to help maybe for sure. Our listeners to have clarity in that conversation.
Yeah, I think so. I use the extreme word because I'm going to own the fact that it is likely more pervasive in me than I even realize.
Okay.
I know it's not intentional. And right. At the same time, if I think about racism as a spectrum, right? And I think about bias, let's say perfection, and then bias, right? Bias is near perfection. We just have a couple biases, let's say a couple unconscious or conscious biases. You know, then we move into a little bit of prejudice, and then we move eventually to some culturalism and then some racism, right? I think that's fine, right? That's acceptable. As far as for some framework, right? You probably have better framework than I do.
Well, I mean, it's my field. I'm actually working on a book that's called The Ultimate Guide to Modern Cultural Terms. And so
excellent. Fantastic.
I think there's a great need for this.
Yes. Well, I would agree. Well, and I would tell you, right, culturally, that is a big challenge, man. Big challenge is the reason we can't understand each other is because we don't use the same meanings for the same words.
Absolutely.
I totally agree. Yeah. Like, I
don't
see
have
that
a common
every,
language about culture.
Nope. No, right. I mean, most people don't even know what a lexicon is. Yes. So how could we have a common one? And I'd say that, right? But I mean that for real, right? So that's the problem. And what happens is often the uneducated feel like they're left out, and they have the educated people are talking down to them, when in reality, we're just using words that are exactly precise for the words that you need. And the problem, right? That's why I use racism, because somebody who may not be familiar with culturalism, come on, Ricardo, right? I mean, now we're just being intellectual elites. And I'd say that kind of joking, but kind of serious, right? I mean,
we're actually being precise, but
that's right. But that's my point. That's my point, right? I know you're being precise. Yeah. I know that. I also know that it is very hard because racism is a charged word.
Yes.
For sure. And technology now makes it so that as I search the word racism, now I see lynchings and I see things.
Yes.
I would never do that, Ricardo. Therefore, I cannot possibly be racist.
Yes.
That is bullshit. And you know that as well as I do, because racism and prejudice and culturalism and all of this is much more pervasive than any of us know.
Often
it's unintentional.
I think, here's my personal view on this. You grew up in this very small town in Wisconsin, and you got to all of your cultural viewpoints and frameworks honestly. You weren't trying to be bad Phil.
No.
You were just Phil.
That's right.
Right? And so my personal viewpoint on this is that every human being gets to exactly where they are, honestly.
Yeah.
And now, if because when I take that viewpoint, it takes the edge off of me, right? Because no longer do I like, oh, what an idiot, or I can't believe that person, or, you know, whatever we may think, or I'm going to call that person out, right? My whole thinking shifts to, I wonder how that person got there.
Yeah.
Right?
Curiosity instead of degradation.
Exactly.
Yep.
And so to me, that's a really important shift in thinking, as one would think in terms of how do I begin to become a master of culture, right? And it's that one initial shift that, you know, I always tell people, if you were born in Turkey or Iraq or Afghanistan, the statistical probability that you are Muslim is over 99%. That is the power of culture.
Yeah, that's right.
And so I tend to look at people and I just go, they got there honestly.
Yeah.
You know, and now as a student of culture, as a student of people, you're in sales and marketing and training. You have to be a student of people.
Yeah.
And every human being is different. Every human being comes from different cultures and different backgrounds. And now if I'm going to be a leader, right? If I'm going to be a person of influence, it becomes my job to study that and to study those people and to learn that if I'm going to market to a certain group of people, then you know what? I have a responsibility to learn that group of people. And so I think that there are a lot of, I want to talk about this. This is going to seem weird to you, maybe, but you're embracing the weird, right?
Absolutely. Every day.
So like to me, the number one technology that changed our world happened, I believe it was in the 1400s. It was the Gutenberg press.
Yeah.
Right. And I look back and I've tried to kind of do an inventory of which technologies most influenced culture. And to me, I keep coming back to the Gutenberg press, you know. What are your thoughts on that? Am I crazy?
No, reading is the central foundational piece of technology. If you can't read, you can't do that. Now, that being said, I don't think you're crazy, but I'm going to rewind even further, and I'm going to tell you ancient hieroglyphics is the first technology, also known as emojis. They are the ultimate technology. If you really think about it, be able to communicate via symbols, because that's all letters are, right? So remove the fact that they're letters as we commonly think of them as A, B, C, D, E, F, G, right? All that. And instead replace them with symbology that indicates, right? What's a tree, Ricardo? There's a symbol for one. What's a smiley face? What's the Filmoji, right? It's the guy with glasses and the buck teeth, right? Yeah. All of this stuff. So I would tell you, yes, Gutenberg press, that certainly democratized it for many, but hieroglyphics going back even further. And now what's funny is we've shifted back to hieroglyphics. And
we're full circle. We're full circle on emojis. Yep,
that's right. And Facebook should really be called Babel, because that's really what it is. If you're biblical, right, it's the Tower of Babel.
Yes.
Because it immediately translates for you. It immediately makes meaning out of things that would normally have no meaning to you.
That is fascinating, man. I hadn't made that connection.
Yep. That's what I think, right? And then along with that, electricity naturally, right? That's a current that now flattened out democracy one more time. And then the car, or let's call it the locomotion, whether it's a bicycle, whatever it is, locomotion really was the next great technology. And the internet then is simply the fiber that connects all of that together in ways that otherwise could not have been. But the key to that is the shared meaning, the shared lexicon of what an emoji means, because even in the internet, ICQ and IRC were the precursors to messenger chat.
Yes.
Right? BBS is the precursor to Facebook.
Right.
All of those things, right?
Just and without all groups. Of the images and symbols.
That's right. Yep. But yeah, well, same symbols, right? Because I remember getting ASCII Christmas trees every year that would clog things up. People would use ASCII. Like if you want to look, do a Google search for Star Wars ASCII, and you'll see somebody has the blowing up of the Death Star that they made in ASCII code. It's insane.
That's fascinating, Phil, because I'll take it a little bit, I don't know if I'm going to take it a little bit deeper or a little bit broader, but the five elements of culture are beliefs, values, norms, symbols, and language, right? So you're really speaking to this element of culture of symbols, right? Because every culture has symbols. So I'm curious, since we're on this conversation, and you mentioned the Death Star of Star Wars, that's a symbol, right? That represents something. What are some other symbols within the American culture that you think are binding symbols of our culture? The obvious one is the flag.
I used to think that the military was a very recognizable symbol, but not as much anymore. The military was very recognizable. You knew an anchor meant the Navy.
Yes.
You knew that you knew things, right? The Eagle, Globe, and Anchor was the Marine Corps. You knew that if they were sitting in a Lazy Boy, that it was the Air Force. And you knew if they were hiding in a swamp, that it was the Army, right? You knew these things. That's how it worked. And if they were fighting in shallow water, they were in the Coast Guard, like little puddles. That's Coast Guard, right? That's how this worked. So I think that's changed, though. I think it's changed. First of all, Coast Guard is now Department of Homeland Security, which is really fascinating. When I was in, they were Department of Transportation.
So if the symbols are not as recognizable, let's say in Gen Z or millennials, right? Then if the symbols are not as recognizable, if they're not as strong, does that weaken then the military?
Absolutely does. Yeah, of course it. I would say, of course it does, right? Anytime, right? Well, think about a stop sign, right? Stop sign has been replaced by a stop light. Now, that being said, that doesn't mean that a stop sign, though, is still in every place. But you notice, like lots of memes, right? Stop, hammer time, stop, collaborate, and listen, right? People make fun of that, but they still see stop. But I go out on the street, ask somebody, what's the symbol for the Marine Corps? You ask somebody that's over 60 years old, they know. They can tell you it's Eagle, Globe, and Anchor. I bet you ask people under 30, they have no idea what it is, unless they serve.
That's fascinating, because that then creates a cultural shift where, and I think the deeper lesson from a cultural standpoint is, if the symbols are weak, it is simply indicative that the culture or the recognition of the symbols are weak. The culture is weak.
Well, it's changed. Well, right? Weak or strong, let's say that it's changed, right?
So everyone knows, like, the symbol of the like Michael Jordan flying through the air.
Yeah, Jumpman logo. Yep.
Yeah, that's pretty strong.
Well, again, it depends. Hold on, depends on the culture though.
Okay.
I'm gonna tell you, right? So little town of Crivets, I bet many of them don't even know who Michael Jordan is if they're under 30. Because Jordan's been retired as long as he played.
Yes. That's true.
And it's not Michael Jordan anymore. It's the Jumpman logo. Jumpman logo is associated with Nike.
Yes.
Who's Michael Jordan? Who cares, right? It doesn't matter. That's a shift, but let's talk about that shift, right, a little bit here. So think about one that's gonna be really divisive. Okay. Let's talk about the Nazi symbol, right? The Nazi symbol was absolutely evil 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. 60s to 90s, yeah, pretty evil. We studied it a lot. 2000 started to weaken. Now we see groups that are perverting it. And we see that though it was weak now, we see a group that doesn't want to let it go and is owning it and trying to give it more power, trying to raise it back up. And it's fascinating, because we have many people that are really angry about that. And we have many people who are like, so what? Big deal. It, you know, that's over, which then leads to the whitewashing of history. Because if it's not a big deal now, why was it ever a big deal? That's the problem, right? People don't read history. that's the real challenge. They don't learn anything from history. I forget who it was, but a great person once said, right, those who learn nothing from the past are condemned to repeat it.
Yes.
And I think that's what we're seeing now. We're seeing these people that it's been 100 years. They don't remember stuff because it's been 2, 3, 4 generations culturally. That weakens our symbols. It weakens our memories. It weakens our language. Because if we don't, again, right, Nazi, supercharged word, but it's much like racism. Is it Nazi, neo-Nazi?
Depends.
Which is it? Which, no, yeah, right, but yeah. Which is? And when we really think about it, back in the early 1900s, Nazism then was neo-Nazism because it really started earlier than that. So it's interesting, right? So the problem is new Nazism, new, it's really everything that's old is new again, because of course it is, because some people will hold on to that. And from a cultural perspective, that's the Dixie flag, that's the sure. Nazi cross, that's, you know, insert here. And so we're removing history, which while many people would say, well, why should we have statues to those who have done atrocious things? The reason why is because if we don't learn from our past mistakes, it isn't there, we forget about it. And to forget about it is the biggest crime of all.
Well, you know, and I was actually going to go there as it relates to the statues and the removal of statues, because statues are symbols, right?
That's right.
And when you, as with the Nazi symbol, when you attempt to repurpose it, that's one thing. But if you attempt to remove the symbols, then you leave a deeper vacuum culturally, historically, that people aren't even aware. I think people don't recognize, Phil, the importance of symbols to a culture, to a people, to a country, yeah, right?
Totally agree. Technology, right? The symbols of technology. If suddenly you removed my E key on my keyboard, I would not be able to communicate in the same way, and that would likely upset me. Okay, pick any symbol like that. If you remove my ability to even discuss it, and then to say, worse yet, to say that E never existed, if much of my DNA is wrapped up in that E key, that's a big problem, man. You're trying to destroy my whole culture? Why would you do that, man?
I think you just said something that's very, very important. And that is, whatever those traditions are, whether viewed now positively or negatively, they are, right? And when you remove them, you remove an essential element of culture, and you're treading on very dangerous waters. I think that's something for all of us to think through in a more thoughtful manner than just a reactive manner to culture of, I don't like this, I want this gone. Well, guess what? It happened.
Right. Absolutely. And which is the acknowledgement without acceptance. And that's important. That's a big distinction, right? I can acknowledge that something happened. I don't have to accept it. I don't have to understand it, but I have to acknowledge, yes, indeed, it did happen.
I would take that further.
Okay.
Because if I acknowledge something, I have to accept that it did happen. I don't have to agree with what happened.
Okay.
And I think a lot of people with culture, it's like, if I don't agree with something, then I want to eliminate it.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. I agree with that. Good point. Yep.
And so then I become the arbiter of all moral truth.
And then, well, now we slippery slope, right? Now we go to moral truth. And ethicism too, right? What's ethically correct? And the answer to that is it depends on our culture.
Yes, the culture defines that.
That's right. Yep. Yep. So here in the United States, it's not ethically okay to eat dog, but in Korea, in parts of Korea, it absolutely is, because they breed special dogs just for that. Like in India, you can't eat a cow.
Right.
Okay. Is that because cow is bad or good? No, it's their culture. Yes. We have to accept that. We have to understand that.
You know, I live in the Dominican Republic, and I don't show this list to anyone. This is private. I have a list of 12 things that in the Dominican Republic are accepted and in fact expected, that if I did in the United States, it would be bad news for me. I go through that list every time I fly into the US before I go into a conference or a speaking engagement or meet with clients to remind myself There are certain things that are acceptable and expected within this culture that simply don't fly in the U.S. culture. That is not being hypocritical. It's being a person who understands the distinctions and nuances of culture and understands my responsibility to adapt to it in order to be able to be effective within it.
Totally agree, right? That you're, you know the symbols of the culture you're in, and therefore you respect them. Without knowledge, we make mistakes accidentally. That's the prejudice and the bias and the racism I was speaking of, right? That's the whole thing. But the fact you know them, you're aware of them, you have them written down, and you understand them now actually makes you much more culturally sensitive.
Clothing is a symbol.
Yeah.
A culture, right? Yeah. So this is a very simple example. If I go to the beach with my family or my wife, and my wife puts on a bikini and I'm in shorts with no shirt, right? That is acceptable within that beach culture. I cannot go to a speech at a major U.S. corporation coming out of that culture and dressed like I'm in that culture. And it sounds like a ridiculous example, but it's a good example to show people, to get us to understand we have to be adapting to multiple cultures actually daily.
Yep.
If we're going to be effective in life. And so many people are hung up on, I don't want to be hypocritical, but it's not hypocrisy. It's actually called wisdom.
And respect.
It's skill.
Yep.
I want to go back to the Gutenberg press.
Back when you were a boy, let's go.
Back when I was a young lad, because the Gutenberg press allowed for knowledge to spread. And it actually, that technology endured for centuries. And it still endures today. I mean, you have published books. I have published books, right? And it's one of those technologies that absolutely 100% changed culture.
Absolutely.
And it's still around. And it's not going anywhere. Do you think that the internet as we know it will still be around 400 or 500 years from now? Do you think it will have the life sustainability of like the Gutenberg press?
Not exactly like it, but absolutely. As a series of small mesh networks, it absolutely will. I think culturally, everybody will run their own internet. And if they allow people to go in and out, they will. I expect there'll probably also be there'll be tariffs between them. There'll be some gates. Sometimes, the paid internet, we're not far because people, you know, it's fascinating. We don't pay a dime for Facebook. We give them all of our data.
Right.
And they sell it back to us, basically. We're going to see a striation between the haves and the have-nots. The haves are going to go totally private. They're going to buy an all-access pass to everywhere on the internet. It's going to be much like Ready Player One. Have you read that book or seen that movie?
I have not.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, you have to see it, right? It's a fantastic.
Ready Player One.
Ready Player One. Fantastic book. The movie isn't as good. Read the book. Read the book. Great, great book. Ernest Cline, great book, right? So, great, great book. Really, really enjoyed it. So, anyway, I think we are getting close to where there is a time where we will have many, many, many more private networks that not everybody can afford to go to, much like we have places, because I really think we're going to be so scared of actual travel that we're going to travel here more than we're in our mind.
Of course, we have virtual reality,
That's right. And that's the Ready Player One model, right? That we're going to travel and wherever we live is just going to be where we subsist, right? And then we're going to escape by putting on our glasses and going somewhere virtually. They're going to stay much like until about, 1970, 80. Most people didn't move within 50 or 100 miles of either they went to college or where they grew up. Okay, well, we're going to see that on the internet too. They're not going to go more than 50 or 100 miles outside of their little bubble technologically. And then they're always going to have people like you and I that are clickbusters that go and flip to everybody's group. And they're like, hey, it's Phil and Ricardo. What's up?
My guest today has been the incredible, the interesting, the intelligent Phil Gerbyshack. You can find Phil Gerbyshack all over the place and hopefully not in deep fake. Phil, it's an honor, man. This is a thrilling conversation. It's an interesting conversation. Love speaking with you every time we speak. So thank you for coming on Culture Matters.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.